Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Starship's success, and the Space Coast celebrates a beloved launch icon. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Third time's the charm, at least for SpaceX's Starship. The company is calling last week's test flight from Texas a success. The spacecraft is key to NASA's moon plans and SpaceX's future. We'll speak with Jeff Brumfiel, senior editor and correspondent on NPR's Science Desk, about the successes and stakes of Starship. Then, the Space Coast is celebrating 321 Day. Get it? A countdown? On March 21st, and celebrating the life of a beloved Brevard icon, Ozzy Osbourne. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? The third test flight of SpaceX's Starship went farther and higher than ever before in a critical test of what is the largest rocket ever made. All eyes were on this test, including those of NASA leadership, as the agency has tapped Starship to land astronauts on the moon. The stakes were high, and SpaceX is calling this test a win. Here to break down what happened and what's ahead is Jeff Brumfiel, senior editor and correspondent on NPR's Science Desk. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
From your reporting, third time is a charm for Starship. Give us a recap. This test flight was, from the ground, looked quite successful. What did you see?
This was undoubtedly their most successful test flight yet. So they were going to launch. They delayed for a little while. It was kind of touch and go for a little bit there. But eventually we got there. They ran through the count. The count was totally smooth. They didn't use any of their built-in holds. And when they fired up Super Heavy, I mean, all the engines lit, very smooth looking takeoff. They have those Mach diamonds everyone loves talking about. It cruised up through max Q, nothing happened. They got to separation. They tried their hot stage separation again, this technique where you have both rockets firing while you separate. Seemed to work very well. And unlike last time, I don't know if you remember, last time when they tried to relight the engines on the first stage, disaster ensued. I guess SpaceX said it was because there was debris, right? This time they got relight, they got that Super Heavy booster headed back towards Earth, and Starship did not catch fire and self-destruct. So that's a win, which is that's what happened on the previous flight. You know, there was an oxygen bleed that caused a fire, and that led to Starship's basic rapid unscheduled disassembly. So anyway, this time Starship fired its engines smoothly. It cruised into orbit. And I think for me, the most surprising thing about the flight was we had, I guess they put Starlink terminals inside of Starship. And so we got this sort of HD video throughout the flight. Certainly we got very smooth, high definition video from cameras on board Starship, and we got some from the Super Heavy. And you know, I think the longer you go into the flight sequence for both the booster and the Starship, things started to go more and more wrong, and we can step through some of what went wrong. But it's hard to sort of underestimate, just in my mind, how big a success this was in terms of getting into orbit, getting some real data from Starship. There was definitely plenty that went wrong, and there's plenty to work on.
Taking a step back, Jeff, you mentioned Flight 1 and 2. You know, I remember from Flight 1, the pad exploded. Flight 2, we've had the self-destruct. And listening to your reporting on NPR leading up to this flight, I was reminded of just how complicated this system is. You spoke with a few experts about it. And I mean, just give us the rundown as to just how incredibly wild it is to get the Super Heavy booster off the ground and Starship in flight as SpaceX did.
First of all, with like the Super Heavy booster, you have these 33 Raptor engines, which are a totally new kind of engine that's never really been used. It's methane and liquid oxygen. They are putting as much propellant and oxidizer through the neck of that engine as they can, as quickly as they can. It is no small thing to get these engines working. Then you have to get them all firing together in such a way that they can lift this rocket straight off the pad. And that's incredibly difficult. My understanding from talking to the experts is that you can get, you know, a much cheaper rocket with a lot more thrust using many smaller engines. But the level of complexity involved with all the sort of thrust control of all those engines and keeping them all in sync is so much higher that during the Apollo program, NASA went with they had five giant engines, and that was just much simpler than trying to put, you know, dozens of engines on there. But SpaceX has validated that now. I think in two flights, I think they have really shown this is a much like vertical landing, you know. That was something that people talked about in the 50s, just wasn't possible back then, and SpaceX made it work. Once again, large numbers of engines in a first stage. It wasn't possible the first time they tried it, you know, 60 years ago, and now SpaceX, I think, has validated that as something that can be done. You know, in terms of Starship itself, the way it was used in launch maybe is not so unique, but it is this giant stainless steel thing. It doesn't have a fairing or anything. It's just kind of like this big old chunk of stainless steel, and getting something that big up into orbit is really tough. I think some of the more difficult technical feats for Starship have yet to happen.
What are some of those technical issues that SpaceX needs to work on? And did we see attempts at that during this last test flight?
So let's start with Super Heavy. Super Heavy returned to Earth. It sort of came down vertically, as you'd expect. Now, as it came down, there was what looked to me like a lot of oscillation. Those grid fins, aero fins, on the side of the rocket looked like they were working hard to keep it stable. And, you know, I don't know what the root cause of that is, but this is a big, heavy thing. And that may have been a technical issue. The bigger issue for Super Heavy was when it tried to relight its engines for the second time, things seemed to go drastically wrong. They got some relights. It didn't look to me, it was sort of like there was one on the inner ring and then a couple on the outer ring. They probably wanted either that inner cluster lid or, you know, something more symmetrical. So I imagine that was the computer trying to fix a problem. But that second relight didn't seem like it worked at all. And so they're going to have to look at what went wrong there. For Starship, it made it into orbit. It made it to the cruise phase of its orbit pretty well. The payload bay door that they want to launch the Starlink satellites out of looked a little bit janky. It's not even entirely clear to me how well it opened. I don't think we know anything about the fuel transfer demo. So one of the things this flight was supposed to do was move some fuel around between tanks. This is very important for future missions for Starship. Starship was also supposed to flip around and slow itself down with a second engine burn. They canceled that burn. We don't know why that was. There was, again, a lot of rolling of the main Starship as it came into the atmosphere. It did not seem like it was aligned for sort of this big, heavy belly flop. And obviously, it was lost, you know, as it came in over the Indian Ocean, southern Indian Ocean, it broke apart. So they lost the spacecraft, which they were going to lose it anyway. It was going to slam into the ocean. But there was plenty that went wrong on the flight in terms of its goals. But, you know, I mean, I think the SpaceX sort of design strategy, which is to continue to fly, fail, iterate and fly again, has really been validated thus far with the Starship program, because they really have made it further with each flight, and they've been able to solve the problems of the previous flights on each flight. And so when they get to the new area, which is reentry and boost back, it's sort of okay, at least the first time, that it doesn't go perfectly. You can definitely make an argument the flight was a failure, but the strategy seems to be working, and that's very, very impressive.
Yeah, and it seems that iteration is leaps and bounds over each test flight. But with that said, you know, last week on the show, Jeff, we spoke about the stakes being extremely high for SpaceX on this program for NASA's moon ambitions and the Artemis lander, and also for the future of SpaceX and what it has planned for Starship outside of taking astronauts to the lunar surface. What do you know about the stakes of Starship, And really just how much is SpaceX relying on this program being a success and being a success relatively soon?
I think there's a very good case to be made that Starship is absolutely central to the future of SpaceX and that the clock is ticking. They need to get it working. And I think the first thing to say is that Starship is important for Starlink. Let me back up even further. Okay. The fundamental problem for SpaceX is they have won the launch market. Okay. They have dominated the launch market. The problem is the launch market isn't all that big. And so if you want to grow further as a space launch company, you got to branch out. And that's what Starlink is all about. Starlink is a much larger market, telecommunications, internet. This is a huge market that SpaceX could grab and they can make money off of and they can get revenue. But only if they have the bandwidth to support millions and millions of users. And to do that, they need more satellites and they need bigger satellites and more powerful satellites. And to get those satellites up in a way that's cost effective, they need Starship. So that's sort of how Starship fits in with the immediate sort of needs for SpaceX as a business. They can continue to launch Starlink. Starlink does work. We've seen that. And I think it's an open question how much they can grow it with just using Falcon 9 launches or if they can make smaller satellites. There may be ways to work around Starship, but Starship is certainly pitched as a big part of their vision. You know, Starship is also central to a bunch of their NASA contracts. They are, getting several billion dollars to develop Starship into a lunar landing system from NASA. So they really need Starship to work. And I think the other thing to just note is that there's been this period where some of the other space launch companies have been developing new rockets to compete with Falcon 9. And so SpaceX has been sort of living high off the hog because they've been the main launch system that's available right now. But that's about to change, right? ULA, yeah, Vulcan's coming up. Bezos's New Glenn, and the Europeans too. I think there is a new European rocket that's going to be coming online relatively soon. So you know, SpaceX is going to have more competition in launch soon, and it also has a need to sort of grow these other revenue streams. And I think this all pivots on getting Starship working. I think there's a good case to be made that this is a real critical live or die thing for SpaceX.
Jeff, I mean, we've seen a lot of successes so far, but really, where does SpaceX need to get to consider this, you know, a successful piece of flight hardware?
I mean, I think it's important, actually, to make this point that, like, they have a long way to go. As amazing as the program has been and some of these flights, what they really want is not only a giant rocket of the sort that no one's ever built before, but a giant rocket that can be reused just very, very rapidly, that can literally be gas backup, the booster and the rocket, and flown again. And that is going to be such a tough problem. You know, the Super Heavy booster, they're talking about catching it back at the launch pad with these chopsticks. That's something no one's done before and seems very dicey to me. Getting Starship to survive reentry in a way where you don't have to do any work with heat tiles or heat shielding, you can just slap it back on top and fly it again. That's a huge technical problem. I don't know how close we are to seeing that solved. So there is a lot that they have to do to get that rapid reusability. And then to get outside of Earth orbit, they've got to do in-space refueling. Never been done before. Huge technical challenges there. So there's a lot left to prove.
Well, Jeff Brumfield is senior editor and correspondent on NPR's Science Desk. He's been covering the Starship launches. Jeff, always great to have you on the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Still to come, the Space Coast community remembers a beloved launch icon, celebrating Ozzy Osbourne on this upcoming 3-2-1 day. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. The Space Coast is celebrating the life of a launch viewing icon here in Florida. Robert Ozzy Osbourne hosted public viewings of rocket launches, no matter the time, from Spaceview Park in Titusville. He's also the reason Brevard County has the 321 area code, a calling card of the region's rocket launching business. Ozzy died last year. On Thursday, March 21st, 3, 2, 1. The American Space Museum and the National Space Society will celebrate the life of Ozzy and his lasting legacy. Here to talk more about Ozzy and the event, which aptly begins at 3:21 p.m., is Mark Marquette, community liaison at the American Space Museum.
Well, Mark, where are we? Can you tell us about this museum that we're at?
Where we're at is the birthplace of the American Space Age, and we're just 10 miles away from where the rocket ranches are across the Indian River. For over 20 years, the American Space Museum has been preserving this history in a unique way, particularly unique because we have artifacts that space workers used, consoles they sat at, manuals, and of course, all kinds of other one-of-a-kind things that have been given to us or donated or acquired through other ways. So it's a fabulous, one-of-a-kind, humble nonprofit that has to be on your bucket list if you're a space geek.
I am a space geek all my life. I've been covering this stuff for almost 10 years now. This is my first time here and was just taken aback by some of the artifacts that you have here. What's some of the response that you get from people that are walking into this museum for the first time?
They usually come from Kennedy Space Center, seeing that beautiful facility out there, and they're overwhelmed by the amount of history and the proximity you are to everything. When I first came here about 7 years ago, to me, it was the greatest space cave I've ever seen. You're so close to everything and can see things up close. But, you know, people are impressed with the fact that this, when you see all of America's space age in one spot, so to speak, it can be overwhelming about what we've achieved. But one of our favorite galleries, and we're proud of, is our Women in Space Gallery that has now 76 women who've orbited the Earth. We have their pictures and a short bio on that. And astronaut Rusty Schweikert in our building not too long ago, and founder of the Association of Space Flight Explorers, he was moved by it. He got his phone out and just did a quick panorama. We're very proud of what we have, and you'll see John Glenn's hard hat, the button that launched him in space, Gus Grissom's suit that he wore after his Gemini 3 flight, just one-of-a-kind things.
When the space shuttle program ended in the early 2010s, there was some concern that excitement for the space program and excitement for this region especially would go away with it. Now we're seeing almost launches pretty much every other day at this point, right? Can you tell me a bit about what has happened over the past decade when it's come to excitement in the Space Coast here?
I've lived here 7 years and moved from East Tennessee and basically to help this museum. That's how passionate I am. And Titusville has changed in this last 5 years because of SpaceX. It really has. I want to say things look cleaner. Businesses are flourishing where it was a ghost town. You've heard the stories. People in masses left subdivisions and their keys in the mailbox telling their bank, you know, I'm done. I have to leave. So it's a rocket renaissance, truly, we're experiencing, and I think we're blessed to be here at this time and see it go up. It is tedious almost to keep up with the cadence of rockets being launched, and I joke that there's another noisy rocket going off this afternoon. So it's a beautiful thing, and once Blue Origin starts launching their gigantic, this is a Saturn-sized rocket called New Glenn, it's even going to be busier.
Rocket renaissance. Does that also translate into more people through your turnstiles at the museum here?
It definitely has, no doubt about it. For the whole community is what I'm saying. I can see just the housing became a problem when the Blue Origin and SpaceX workers have moved in here, and everything that supports that. Every dime spent on the space age has been spent here with homes, education, buying groceries, and you know, the Space Coast is really coming back. I'm on several community boards, and, you know, I've had realtors stand up and say, I ain't got any property to sell. You guys want to sell your house, you know, give me a call. But it's just a wonderful time to be here. Our museum, I'd say, has at least doubled in attendance here. We have a great deal of clientele from Germany, Italy. A lot of Dutch come here. And of course, the attractions bring them in Orlando, but then a lot of people are budgeting a day here, and it takes a half a day maybe to go through and absorb our little museum here. But you're going to see things that you'll never see anywhere else, and we're very proud of that.
You're planning to take that enthusiasm outside the museum to 3-2-1 day.
tell us a bit about what the plan is for that event.
3-2-1 Day on March 21st this year is the inaugural event to celebrate the life of a man called Ozzy Osbourne. Robert was his name. Some people called him Bob, but he went by Ozzy Osbourne a lot. And for almost three decades, he was a fixture at Spaceview Park, where you can see the launches across the Indian River. Just 10 miles away is the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral. And he became the self-proclaimed rocket hobo. And he was a character with a shock of white beard and white hair, passed away in August at age 72 of natural causes. And he's dearly missed out there at the launches as the guy that sat in the chair, gave you the countdown. Kind of rarely was he right. It usually went off about five or after the zero, because it's hard to coordinate that with the exact time on phones and stuff. But I loved hearing him yell scrub, you know, at the top of his lungs when it would be scrubbed. Then he'd grab that coffee can tip jar and stand out there and get tips from people that he well deserved. Well, Ozzy Osbourne, we're going to celebrate that with the National Space Society with a downtown Titusville party that is tied into Ozzy's 321 area code. Why do I say Ozzy's 321 area code? He is the man that when Orlando had to split, got so large in 1990s that they needed a new area code and gave Orlando the 407 area code. They had to need a new area code for the Titusville and Space Coast. 321 was available. Ozzy found that. Was available. It's usually an area code given up in New England area because of the low number. And he championed with the Federal Trade Commission to lobby to have this on. And it worked. And in 1999, the first phone call from the 321 area code was made. The rest is history. So March 21st is logical to celebrate that, but to recognize a man that had his tentacles in a little bit of everything. He was involved with the 22 Museums of Brevard as their webmaster. He was involved at libraries, missed him, okay? If you were in the Radio Shack world of the day, he, I understand, strapped a Tandy a computer on his chest, an antenna on his back, and a camera, and walked around doing live feeds. One of the first guys to do that, you know. So quite a character, but an intelligent man, an Army veteran. And we want to honor him every year with the area code 321 Day, but have it turn into honoring the super space geek that he was. At 321, we're going to converge out where he would give have his reports and the countdown. Appropriate time, we're going to come over to the downtown Titusville Welcome Center, where the mayor's going to have a proclamation. We'll have comments from other people. We got three food trucks, a rock and roll band, and everyone's going to have a party for Ozzy until about 9 o'clock on Thursday, March 21st this year.
I had the chance to meet Ozzy on the first assignment I ever did covering space for WMFE. He showed me the ropes. He showed me spent so much time explaining what was happening and what I could expect from Spaceview Park. That is not an isolated incident. Many people have had that experience with Ozzy. What do you think he would say about this celebration of him?
He would be amazed, I think. He was a humble guy. You know, I see Ozzy, say, Ozzy, how you doing? And his reply would always be, strange as usual, you know. And he prided himself on being the eclectic person that he was. And I said to somebody, I said, can you imagine me or you dying and somebody doing this for you? This is an incredible, lasting tribute. But his brother is the last of his family here from Rochester, Steve Osbourne. So I'll live it through Ozzy's eyes through him on there. But it's truly an incredible tribute. I can't recall seeing anything quite like this in my years of being around publicity and public relations and stuff like that. It's so we're got some great momentum and good support. And if nothing else, come out and enjoy the street party with a band that is all space workers. And then we hope to turn it into an annual celebration. Titusville Chambers behind it and some other organizations.
Mark, rockets continue to launch even without Ozzy there. Is there someone who is following in his footsteps, or is his legacy still there at Spaceview Park for these launches?
Well, no one has filled their shoes. I'd like to be the old man doing that in some point in my life.
You need whiter hair.
I do. Thank you. And more hair. Thank you, for sure. Probably not. You know, these type of people are so unique in our lives. When you look back at your experiences in your lives and maybe the vacation places you've been, people are going to come from Findlay, Ohio down here and see their only launch. And if they saw that, if Ozzy was there, they're going to remember that rocket launch and the thrill of that. And then they're going to remember this white-haired guy that was giving the countdown and getting everybody into it and having a good time. I think we all, you know, maybe remember the gondola driver, you know, better than you do the trip, some sort of a thing. So it's a hard shoes to fill. Certainly someone can go there and do the countdown and maybe even a little better than him with more technology and so forth. But that's what we love about people that we encounter in life, is they can embrace their flaws and make us feel comfortable in our own selves. And not that Ozzy had a lot of flaws, but he's lived very humble. He didn't have a lot of money in his retirement. He was very happy with what he was doing. But what Ozzy took with him, he left more than what he took, okay? And that is a beautiful thing. He left a legacy of this 321 area code. And then he left a legacy of a space geek who just wants to bridge the space between us.
And perhaps the next Ozzy will be in your museum in the very near future.
Could be. My hair's rising on my arms, as you can see here, because of just thinking about this man. On a hot summer day, and we had a lot of them the last few years I've been here, I'd take him two bottles of frozen water and a fresh one and some snacks out there, because usually he'd forget to do that, you know. Or if he didn't need it, I'm sure he'd pass it on to someone else that did. But I miss that. I miss taking out our little A-frame advertising thing out there and not seeing him out there. I mean, he was out there at 4 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. So we hope that people could come out and enjoy that. We'll post more things in our American Space Museum Facebook. But a kind soul that didn't ask much from anybody, but gave a lot.
Mark Marquette, thank you so much for sharing this museum and sharing the legacy of Ozzy Osbourne with us.
Our pleasure. And like I said, we want to see you again to bridge the space between us.
The Space Coast is celebrating 321 Day on March 21st. And this podcast has a reason to celebrate, too. The day marks this show's 8th birthday. Thanks to all you loyal listeners, and here's to many, many more years of exploring space exploration together. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or even on YouTube. Really, wherever you get your podcasts, you can get us. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Emily Ching. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.